All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Got some very exciting news that I'd like to share with you. Don't freak out. I'm not getting married. There's no baby. But before I talk to you about it, Walter Hill, the director, is on the show, which was pretty fucking exciting for me because I like Walter Hill. I like a lot of his movies. And back when I was a younger person, I was always excited to see his movies. When I was, I would have been in high school. Yeah, I was a little high school film nerd. And I remember, you know, being excited to see Walter Hill movies. But like, I'll talk about that in a second. What I want to talk about, big news to announce right now. You can officially pre-order Waiting for the Punch, Words to Live By from the WTF podcast. It's the WTF book that Brendan and I have been working on for the last 2 years, and I'm holding it. Right now, I'm holding a galley copy of our book and your book, soon to be your book, and a book of all the people that were part of it. This book, it's like, how can I explain it? It's not just a collection of interview transcripts, right? We took quotes and stories and conversations from about 200 guests from this show and created sort of a running narrative about life. You can go to markmaronbook.com or just go to WTFpod.com and click on the book on the top of the page to pre-order this amazing thing. I couldn't believe it when I read through it. I mean, it's so fluid and it's so exciting to read. And to be honest with you, I don't really remember a lot of the conversations I have here. Some of them were a while ago, and I only listen to them in real time. Brendan's the guy that does the polish and the cutting on the thing. Now, the way it's organized is that each chapter covers like a different topic. You got childhood, relationships, sexuality, success, failure, stuff like that, all right? So we put it together that way. And what we were trying to do by weaving all these conversations together is just make it feel like everyone is part of this big conversation. It's sort of like a guide to life, if that's possible. And I think some of you feel that way about this podcast, a certain number of you. Now, the weird thing about it is, like I said, I read it. And when we were editing it, obviously, you know, Brendan did a lion's share of the work on putting this together. But the weird thing is when you read all of these things together, the impact is it's like pretty powerful. It's funny, it's tragic, it's joyous, it's heartbreaking. It's really strangely profound. And we're very proud of this book. I was just astounded because, like I said before, I have these conversations, but I don't know if I process them in the same way that you do when you read something, you know? And it's very interesting to read pieces of conversations that were spoken as opposed to written. You engage with it in a totally different way. And it all works together. I couldn't put it down, and I was the one that had the fucking conversations. It's a nice big book. It's 400 pages long. There's 12 new essays in it by me. John Oliver wrote the foreword for us. Very nice of him. And if you're a listener of the show, it's really the best possible physical representation of what we do. And, you know, that's how we feel about it. Also, talking book stuff, on June 3rd, I'm going to be at the Book Con in New York City with Brendan McDonald, my collaborator and business partner and producer. And this event will be the first public unveiling of the book. And if you're there to see us talk about it, you will get an advance copy. Go to thebookcon.com for tickets. If you order tickets now, they're still doing an early bird price, and it's still early enough to get the tickets mailed to you. So get on that now if you want to see us at the Book Con and get an advanced copy of Waiting for the Punch. That's thebookcon.com. It is fucking awesome. I like the cover. You know, this whole process was really a pretty amazing thing because, you know, we've talked to so many people and, you know, Brendan, like I said, who has an incredible memory and is a very skillful putter together of things, man, It just, it's very exciting. So I'm looking forward to you guys getting it. Now, you can go to markmaronbook.com or use the book link at WTFpod.com or just go to wherever you order books online. Very exciting. Oh, my God. So I was in Portland, and I did three shows at the Aladdin. I love the Aladdin, and I'm trying to work out this special, and it's coming along good. I tell you, the part of the job where you organize and pull things together and, you know, polish things up, it's exciting, but it's a little tedious, and I have to be careful that it doesn't suck the fun out of it for me. But it is part of the job, and I'm trying to hone up or hone down or hone in on or hone a set that's been running an hour and a half, an hour 45 minutes. And that leaves room for a lot of improvising. But for Netflix, they kind of want about a 70-minute thing, 75 minutes all in for the special. So that's probably about 70 minutes of stand-up. So I have to trim like 25 minutes, and it's not so much that I'm more attached to bits than others, but it's like, how's it all going to flow together? So now I'm like, finally, you know, less than a week away from the special. And I'm like, maybe I should tighten this up a bit. So Portland was very helpful in letting me do that. And the audiences were great. That Aladdin, I've worked there many times, and I'll always go back there. It seats about 600, sold out three shows, and the audiences were just fucking amazing. I had a local comic open for me, Barbara Holm. She did a great job. And I just I love going to Portland, even though every time I go there, I directly and immediately connect with some sort of pervading old-timey darkness that I believe just simmers under the entire city. I don't know what the apparitions are or what the spirits are or what they're kind of mildly aggravated about, but I always feel it there. And it's not a negative thing. I'm not saying anything negative about Portland. It adds to the charm. The weird old-timey darkness is constantly sort of engaging with the fancy facial hairs and coffee shops and artisanal occupations to create an interesting but kind of heavy vibe, man. This is how I read it. I have a poetic experience every time I go to Portland. Generally, I have some good coffee, some good food, but I walk over bridges and I'm like, man, there's something here, man. There's something going on here. And it never goes away, but I feed on it. I think I have a good relationship with the Portland spirits that just lie beneath the city, maybe also in the water there. So, oh yeah, I was at the Portland airport today and I had a beautiful moment. You know, sometimes when I'm a little punchy, I'm a little tired, things are a little shaky around the edges, you know, because I don't do drugs anymore, so I have to exhaust myself in order to relax in that way. But there was just something happening at the Portland airport. I went to the main area and there was a guy playing classical guitar. It was amplified, but just a man sitting there playing a classical piece on an acoustic classical guitar. It sounded like that. I don't know the piece. I would never know the piece, but you know what I'm saying? It sounded like a guy playing classical guitar. He had it, you know, perched on the wrong knee if you're a regular guitar player, but it looks more disciplined. You know, everything about playing classical guitar looks earned. And he's just playing, and it's pretty, you know, it's nice. It's classical guitar music. It's okay. It was relaxing, but like, I didn't know exactly where it was coming from at first. And I look over and I see the guy just over there off to the wherever, the side, sitting perched with his guitar in his guitar case. They obviously allow entertainers to play in the foyer there at the Portland airport. But what was beautiful is there was this little boy. I guess he's around two. I don't know how to read that because I don't have children of my own. But he was a little boy, probably about two. He was walking and standing, you know, looked like he was excited to be standing up. But he was just standing there in front of this classical guitar player, just entranced, you know, just like, you know, could not shift his eye, like just hypnotized by the classical music. This little kid, you know, who's got no preconceptions, got no understanding, you know, of what he's watching or what the sound is or what it's like. Just complete engagement with this beautiful, elegant music. And I was completely fascinated and engaged with the kid watching the guy play guitar. I was engaged and fascinated in almost a childlike way watching a child who was engaged and fascinated in a childlike way because he's a child with a classical guitar player. It was just so beautiful to see a kid that innocent, so taken with something so elegant and beautiful and sounds so amazing. And then I look over to the right and there's his mother also fascinated and engaged with her kid, I'm assuming, watching the guitar player while he was fascinated and getting engaged. And she was smiling. And then like I started to think like, am I being weird right now? No. I didn't want to look weird. But I couldn't stop looking at this kid, looking at the guitar player because he was so into it. And then every once in a while, he'd do a little kid dance that didn't quite match up with the music. But I think it's just an excitement thing. And all I could think was like, this might be the moment. This kid might, you know, this might be the deciding factor of the future of his life. This moment right now might be wiring something into him that may guide him for the rest of his life. I don't know how. I'm not going to make any assumptions. But yet, maybe he'll become a composer or a conductor or at the very least a guitar player. I don't know, but I felt it was happening, that there was some sort of deep discovery going on. And I was very happy it was that and not something on a screen or maybe a puppet show. It just felt deeper. And like it made me made my morning, really. And like I witnessed the moment where he disengaged, but he was locked in for like a couple of minutes, you know, and I think that's kind of rare for kids that age. And then I saw him get distracted with nothing, just like something, it went away. The circuit was broken. But I think something was delivered, man. It was something to see. And I know some of you are thinking like, oh, Mark, you should have a kid. So Walter Hill. I'll tell you what I remember most, like outside of seeing Warriors when it came out, which was what? Yeah. Where was I in my life when Warriors came out? 1979. So I was in high school. How fucking great was that? I don't know if the movie holds up, but like at the time it was fucking great. Can you dig it? Warriors, come out to play. Come on. I didn't realize that he was so active in the 70s and he wrote The Getaway and he The Macintosh Man, The Thief Who Came to Dinner. He wrote and directed Hard Times. Like there was a lot I learned and a lot I talked to him about. But he was one of those guys when me and my buddy Devin Jackson were just sort of young film nerds. We dug him. We dug Walter Hill. I remember when The Long Riders was coming out and we were just sort of like, how can this not be great, man? Walter Hill, all the James Gang, but it's all brothers and they're really brothers in real life. Southern Comfort with Powers Booth. I was excited about that. He did 48 Hours. I mean, I don't know, man. He's from the old school and it was just a thrill to talk to him. I like talking to directors and his new movie is sort of it's a messy trip, man. It's called The Assignment. It's available on iTunes and video on demand. It's a slasher movie, and he's very aware of what it was and what it is and how he made it and why he wanted to make it that way. And it's of that genre, which I don't watch a lot of, I think it's pretty disturbing and kind of good, you know, in that way that slasher movies are. I guess you call it slasher, horror. It doesn't matter. If you want to watch it, go watch it. I didn't realize when I talked to him that he directed Geronimo, which I don't know. Like it's one of those movies that like John Milius wrote it. It's a very big movie with Jason Patrick and Robert Duvall, Gene Hack. It was just he's a real deal director, and it was a real honor to have him. This is me talking to Walter Hill. So your movies, when I was younger, I always look forward to your movies. I remember, it's funny, I was going over them and I'm like, holy shit, I remember how excited we were for that for The Long Riders. It's a great movie.
Thank you.
Where'd you start out? Here? I mean, did you grow up here?
Yeah, I'm from, well, I always say Long Beach.
Yeah.
My family worked in Long Beach. I actually grew up in Bellflower and went to Bellflower High when, but nobody knows where the hell Bellflower is. So
where is Bellflower? Let's solve it.
It's basically in North Long Beach.
So. Oh, okay, so it's down there.
Yeah.
And you just, what was your family in the business? Was anyone
They were, my family's been in Southern California a long time.
Since the Cowboys?
Nah, my mother was born downtown Los Angeles, the back of a grocery store. Her parents owned a grocery store on, she was born in Slauson in Vermont, downtown. They moved into the Long Beach area. Grocery store didn't do terribly well.
Got out of that racket.
So, yeah. And my father's father was a Wildcat Oil.
Oh, really?
Miller, and he ended up in the Signal Hill area of Long Beach, which, of course, was a big oil field back in the 1920s, 1930s.
No 40s. Kidding. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
A lot of oil.
Yeah. It was the wonder field of the world at the time. And so.
He was the guy on the machines?
He was a driller, and then he became an owner and operator. You know, he always said as long as he wasn't drilling for his own. For himself, they were all big winners, but as soon as he drilled one...
for himself?
Yeah.
You come from a big family?
No. Brother.
Yeah.
My folks had two kids.
Yeah.
Brother and I.
He going to show business?
No.
Yeah.
He ran the transportation department, city of Long Beach, for years. If it had wheels on it or was a boat in the harbor...
Yeah.
I mean, buses, police cars, fire engines, and all that. He was in charge of maintaining and purchasing.
For the city.
And it was a socially enormously useful job and one that I probably couldn't handle for even a day. And he was very good at it, and he finally retired a couple years ago.
Oh, that's good. Had a good life, retired.
Yeah, he's now devotes himself to the sports page and...
relaxing.
Yeah.
So how'd you get into pictures?
Well,
you probably told the story before, obviously, but I'm curious about the era. I don't get the opportunity to talk to people about Hollywood when it was sort of a small town.
Well, I usually just say, you know, I flunked my Army physical. I was supposed to go in the Army. I got out of school.
But you wanted to go.
I was certainly willing to go.
Yeah.
And I was childhood asthma. So they said the last second, I remember this guy came, but we were all standing there.
Yeah.
In the RAW, and the guy comes in and says, Jesus Christ, they're not going to take us to fucking Fort Ord. They're going to take us to fucking Fort Polk, Louisiana. Oh. Oh, you don't understand. I mean, you have no idea. It's the worst fucking place on earth.
Really?
Yeah. Well, the weather's horrible. Yeah. And but after you're done with basic... at fucking Fort Polk, they put you right into the light artillery. It's the place where the light artillery comes out of.
Uh-huh.
Light artillery? You know, what do we, you know?
Yeah.
He said, that's everything with the infantry, except you have to wear three times heavier pack. You gotta lug the fucking mortars around and the fucking mortar shells. He said, it's the worst thing in the Army. Oh, you know, he's going, God almighty, Fort Polk, Louisiana.
For that was your introduction, huh?
Well, and then you get to the last table, and the doctor says, well, I don't think we're going to need your services, Mr. Hill, and we're a childhood asthma. We don't want to need a lot of allergies, and et cetera, so we'll make you 1Y. And
so you probably dodged a bullet, literally.
I guess so. so anyway... I was at liberty. I thought I might get into journalism somehow, but through a series of kind of accidents and small, I got connected to people making educational films. And suddenly, and I was a great fan of movies. I just never could imagine making a living.
Doing movies. Really?
And,
even though there were movie stars? And I guess it seems like a stretch.
Well, Long Beach was forever distant from all that.
But were you a movie fan as a kid?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. I was you know, my brother and I, every weekend, four movies a week.
Oh, who are your favorites?
Well,
when you're a kid.
I guess I liked the Westerns the best. But,
yeah.
You know, it was, I think I was pretty eclectic in, in my taste. On Saturdays, you saw the first run movies, and on Sunday, you went over to the other theater that showed B Westerns.
Uh-huh.
And so we saw whatever came around. And
so you weren't so locked in that you had favorite directors necessarily?
Oh, I didn't know what a director did.
Sure,
I knew it was the last credit.
Yeah.
But loved the whole experience. And you know, it was like a religious temple or something. You went in and they were gods and they were larger than life. You know, my kids get cheated out of this. They, you know, you couldn't miss anything. And, you know, you weren't going to come back. You weren't going to see the movie again.
Yeah.
So, you know, you had to hold a pee and you know, and you either took food with you but you weren't going to, because anything you missed. And now, of course, you know, and the size of the screen was enormous.
Huge.
And so the experience was very special. But now, you know, they buy the film and they can stop at any time they want. Watch on the computer. They can watch on something that's not bigger than their watch. And also they can run it in slow motion. They can run it sideways. They can do anything they want with it. And if they think they miss something, they'll just run it right back. And
yeah, I think that has diminished the specific power of the movie going experience.
Yeah,
for
it's taken away the magic of it so much.
Yeah, it's a shame. I think the magic is leaving everything slowly.
yeah, I suppose so. But I do believe. Look, I do think the human beast has a tremendous need for stories, for entertainment. You know, I believe you go to the smallest village in Tibet, not that I have, but there's an aerial on the small house, and they're in there watching I Love Lucy or something. Yeah. And so that we're obviously living through a time where the delivery system is changing, and where the story is being delivered is changing, and the neighborhood theaters that I grew up with, I mean, they're vanishing. And
there's a few around. I guess Tarantino's doing something with that New Beverly, and some of the higher end theaters are good. But you're right, I never really thought about it like that, because lately I've been thinking, just for myself, when I watch something, am I avoiding something else? Is this a distraction? Am I doing this as some sort of pseudo drug experience to detach myself? But I think that there is a need within. It's an emotional journey. It's necessary. It's sort of it's nourishing to the soul.
Well, you know, we have to somehow get our imaginary lives and some kind of wish dream fulfillment.
Right.
I've never. It's too deep for me, but. You know, I always say a good story. I like a good story, and I don't know. It's something I always say that, you know, everybody has three lives. There's the, you know, you and I meet today. We're doing this, and I present a certain framework to you. You present a certain framework to me. Our public persona. Then we have our private life that we share with people that are very close with us, usually.
Someone we drag through it.
Drag through. And then you have your secret life of where it's inside your head, and you basically share it with no one, I think. Just glimmers of it a bit.
The safe glimmers.
Yeah.
That won't cause
that's
much
right.
trouble.
Yeah. But I think that part is what needs to be satisfied by the stories and the.
I think that's good. That's a good way. That's deep. That works for me. So you're making educational docs.
Well, I never did. I mean, I just worked on them, and then
in what capacity?
I did research.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and then I wrote parts of them, but I immediately said to myself, "What the fuck am I doing? You know, I don't even like these movies. They're basically people sitting at a desk." you know, as they used to say, riding with a feather.
Uh-huh. And what was the company?
It was an offshoot of Encyclopedia Britannica movies. They used to make these 16 millimeter films for students, you know, schools.
Yeah.
And I was in this environment of around filmmaking, and I somehow within, I don't know, a very short amount of time, I knew exactly what I wanted. I went from zero understanding to I wanted to write and direct movies. I thought I'm going to do it.
So you can make the connection now that you know, you're a little behind the scenes, like, oh, this is, and it's not as daunting necessarily.
And I was a good reader about films. I was not only a good viewer.
Yeah.
And my taste had improved a lot in some ways in the last, in that few years from the time I was, say, maybe 17.
What was the indicator of that?
I think what we used to call foreign films.
They were coming in.
They were coming in, and I was a great, I loved Kurosawa, and I loved to watch a Bergman or a Fellini or something. You know,
like Seven Samurai, kind of like that movie?
Seven Samurai.
Yeah. Rashomon.
Is both on the all-time list.
Sure.
Rightfully.
Yeah.
And I think when I really started to work and get going, it was somehow, I would never have defined my own dream or anything, which already sounds pretentious, but was to somehow, I always wanted to do action films, genre films.
Sure.
But to kind of inform them with what seemed to me to be this new vision coming out of Europe and Asia, that there was a less melodramatic, they were smart, the movies were smart.
A little more than meets the eye.
Yeah.
Essentially.
And, they weren't, you know, Kurosawa could do an action movie.
Yeah.
They were so good that they weren't even called action movies. They were dramas. But they were done with a superior intelligence and greater visual styles, so in more advanced editing. And so that was, to me, the paradigm to be kind of reaching for. And then some of the directors I fell in with, most particularly working with Peckinpah, I suppose. So, you know, shared that.
Yeah, he was something else. How did you eventually make it onto sets and start, you know, engaging with the film business?
Well, I became an assistant director. While I was trying to make a living as a writer, I would write at night, but I got a job as a, at first an apprentice assistant director, what we now call production assistant. And then I got into the Directors Guild as a second assistant.
Yeah.
And I worked on a number of films. I worked on Bullet and Take the Money and Run. And
Take the Money and Run, the Woody Allen movie?
Yeah. Yeah, Woody's first film. I was the second on it.
Really?
That
must have been kind of funny because they were all bits and there's a lot of sketches almost.
They were very funny. Well, he shot a lot of the movie. We shot the movie in the summer of 1968 in San Francisco.
Oh, this must have been crazy.
But, it was. And it was, you know, looked like the country was falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
We were on the streets a lot of the time. But Woody then, I don't know what, they evaluated the film they had when he went home at the end of the summer. And then they shot a lot more in New York. They shot a lot more of the bits.
Because it was a fake documentary, right, in my recollection.
Yeah, they were it was the Virgil Starkwell, I think his name was.
Yeah.
And which was a play on the Starkweather, who had been a real...
Very straight, horrible, killer horrible guy.
Yeah, and he was fun to be around. And
Bullet, that's a whole other experience. They shot that in San Francisco, too, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was up there for... better part of a year, and then I took off after Bullet started in February of 1968.
Yeah,
and we went about 8 weeks over, I think, or something.
Wow, who directed that one?
Peter Yates, and we shot the chase right at the end. So
that was the chase that established the modern car chase.
It sure did.
That and the French Connection, I guess, were the two big ones.
Absolutely. And then Take the Money was shot in the summer of 68. And then I took the fall and winter off and stayed up there. And I started writing with I had enough money in my bank account from
to take the time to
yeah,
do
yeah, that I could.
Now, were you reading scripts and stuff? Were you doing? Did you do television as well at that time?
No, I never did. Yeah, I did read, of course. I read scripts. I had several complicated notions about all that. One, I thought, well, Christ, I think I can do this.
Sure.
If that's what they were buying. yeah. The arrogance of, yeah.
Youth.
Of youth. Yes. Uh-huh. I also was somewhat distressed. It seemed to me that almost all these scripts seemed to have been written by the same person.
Yeah.
There was a kind of uniformity of style and approach to screenwriting that made it seem like it was coming out of some big machine.
Yeah.
Occasionally, that's... It's like anything, you'd try to generalize about this business or something like that.
Well,
there are exceptions.
I think everyone's trying to do what makes money. So if someone's not particularly gifted, they're just going to format the thing.
And also, they were not particularly reader-friendly. So I, taking these as my watchwords, tried to resist. One, I wanted to kind of make a mark with my scripts, I think.
And yeah.
I wanted to give them a certain style that evolved. I thought they were almost all overwritten and all way too melodramatic.
A little too much information on the page?
Yeah. And also, because I had worked on movies, I knew nobody paid any goddamn attention to this stuff
anyway. Stage direction.
Yeah. So,
they just knew when the new scene was.
Yeah. So, listen, I don't mean to demean. There were a lot of very talented, very hardworking screenwriters that... had to work for very difficult people.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand the full
spectrum of it at that time.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah.
The wide...
Yeah.
I forget they can't see my hands.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes,
yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
It was good. I got it right away. So what was that script that you wrote?
Well, the first script I wrote that became a film, I sold a Western that did not get made, and then... my problem was I never could finish anything.
Yeah.
I must have written 20 scripts and never quite. And then I finally said, look, you know, if you're going to do this, you better finish the goddamn
thing. Was it a fear thing? Was it just I used to be like that. And then it's something weird. There's something weird about finishing things.
I think probably that may have been part of it. I just attributed it to... I had written myself into a box, you know,
right.
Painted myself into a corner.
Didn't know how to end it?
Yeah, and just the strategy was wrong. Or I felt that it was headed in a wrong direction, and the only way to finish it was a kind of compromise, and and what the story was wouldn't even accept the compromise. You know, you build up all kinds
of
very complicated reasons for non-performance. And
a lot of reasons.
Yeah, there's a lot of very solid reasons for your failure.
That's how some people use their imagination.
Exactly. So I had the buckle down moment where we better start finishing. And luckily... Once I really started finishing scripts, I started selling almost right, making a living at it right away. And I think the second thing I sold became a movie. It was called Hickey and Boggs with Robert Culp and Bill Cosby. And I got hired to do a couple of rewrites, and then I was hired to write The Getaway. Peter Bogdanovich hired me to write The Getaway.
I talked to him.
You did?
I did. He's a character.
He is. He is indeed.
Well, I imagine at that time, you know, judging by my experience with him here, is that he had a very, you know, unlike you're talking about, he had a true respect for film, the medium, and the power of film and the genre movie, because he was very adamant at not necessarily being connected to that generation of directors that he came from, because he saw himself as a guy that didn't want to necessarily break the mold, but wanted to make amazing studio pictures.
Yeah, he saw himself, I think, I mean, I don't want to speak for him, but is continuing the chain of great directors in the tradition of Leo McCarey and John Ford and Howard Hawks.
Exactly,
And Raoul Walsh, etc. And He did not feel this great rush of 1968 and the need to swing the hammer and smash the cement and kick it all aside.
Yeah.
Go on to some new plane that was very much the fashion.
Did you?
I was probably a little more on Peter's side of the argument than the other side, but because I really did have great reverence for so many really good directors of the past. You could see that the times were changing and that something was going on, and you weren't going to be able to. My feeling was that you were not going to reinvent the cinema. That was insane, but it was a lot of the talk at the time. It's hard to imagine how crazy things were, back then. But I certainly thought that genre filmmaking, although it was going to change, could be redone in a way, pulling things inside out and mixing genres, and that you could make them fresh and that an audience would grab onto them. And you know, if you're working here, you have to be thinking about, am I going to be able to find an audience for this? Because otherwise you don't come back to the party.
Right.
And in those days, you know, the means of production, to use the great Marxian term, the means of production were totally held by the studios, so you had to kind of somehow get into this club and function within it. And it was so, you know, what's an audience? What do they want? Well, there was an old expression that if you're going to tell a new story, you had to put the characters in old clothes. And if you're going to tell an old story, you had to put the characters in new clothes. Because
I've never heard that.
Yeah, old clothes, old story, dead.
Yeah.
New story, new clothes. Nobody knows. Nobody can attach themselves to it.
Right.
It's too far.
New story, old clothes.
New story, you might be in business. Or old story, new clothes, you know.
Sure.
You might be in business.
And then it turns out they're all old stories in new clothes.
Well, you know, Borges says there are only two stories.
Yeah.
So when you boil them down.
What are they?
The Crucifixion.
Yeah.
And the Odyssey.
Okay. Well, that's probably about right.
It's pretty hard to think of anything that doesn't
fall within that.
You might also say if you make your categories wide enough, everything will.
Sure.
But
it's interesting you said that so many people, you thought they had this vision that they were going to reinvent cinema, but what they ultimately did was just expand it, you know, broaden an audience, right? I mean, the 60s did something. I mean, they didn't reinvent cinema, but they certainly, you know, created a shift, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, there was a paradigm shift that in storytelling, you know, there were so many. You know, Friedkin's French Connection, Billy's movie, just the ending was such a, you know, the technique of making the film and the approach to character, the Popeye, and, you know, finally, it's a really good example of new clothes, old story, except there was a new ending, a much different and very adult, and we're still trying to figure out what the hell happened. And the whole approach to character that Hackman played, and you'd never seen a cop like that.
So The Getaway, so you start that with Peter, and then how does it
move?
Well,
Peter and Steve had a separation.
McQueen a nice guy?
Is he a nice guy? I liked Steve. I did. He was a very wary personality. He was aware of the pitfalls that can be followed. An actor. He saw himself very much as, it doesn't sound kind what I'm about to say, but I don't mean it that way. He saw himself very much as a star.
Yeah.
And he thought of a star as being, as most people did in those days, a lot more than being an actor.
Uh-huh.
And he felt his responsibilities as a star. He felt his responsibilities to his audience.
Right.
And they wanted to see him win.
Right.
They wanted to see him be
right. Cool. He wasn't going to dirty himself up.
Well, he wasn't going to not be what he felt the image of McQueen was, and he didn't, because he was not going to let his fans down. And he would justify a lot of things in terms of, no, they don't want to see that, or they.
Yeah.
He was a very generous actor in the sense of. he didn't care that much about taking the dialogue. He would quite often give dialogue away, and he was certainly masterful at saying, "We don't need to say this." And
He's a pretty subtle actor.
Oh yeah, yeah. He was a great. You know, he understood his power. He could dominate a scene with a look, or just a simple gesture. You know, somebody would be talking away, and he could just reach over and grab an apple and start to peel the apple. Now, some might say that's a cheap way to upstage, and others would say, you know, it was an absolute reflection of his persona and who he was playing in that particular film.
Yeah, they're both can exist, those interpretations.
Yeah, and but he was a wary personality.
Yeah.
He didn't allow a posse to build up that so many of the very successful superstars do.
Sure.
He was not like that. I think he was really at most comfortable around his friends that had to do with cars and motorcycles.
Yeah, that was his thing, yeah.
Well, it was more than a hobby. I mean, he had a tremendous gut instinct for mechanics, making something go fast. I mean,
that's what made him good for The Getaway.
That's it. Made him very good for he felt it right down to the essence of it.
Did you write it? So you were working with Peter on it, but you ended up writing your own script for it.
Well, it was an adaptation of a Jim Thompson novel.
Oh, Jim's great, huh? He just passed away, didn't he?
No, it's been a few years.
Oh, it has,
now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Peter was directing Barbara Streisand in the What's Up, Doc?
Yeah.
And Steve decided that he couldn't wait, and that we had to get rolling. So they encouraged me to quickly finish the first draft, which I did. Sam came in. Sam agreed, read the script, and was willing to work with Steve again. They had had a somewhat explosive relationship on Junior Bonner, I think it was. But they had great respect for each other. Steve threw a magnum of champagne at Sam's head in one story conference, I remember. I actually was not there, but I saw the hole in the wall.
The next day. Meant it.
It was one of the few times where Sam really was, he said, you know, motherfucker would have killed me.
No kidding. So when you did The Getaway, it sounds like you were pretty engaged with the whole process. I mean, were you on set as well? And yeah,
I got called off. I was going to be on set, but I got called off. I had to do a thing for Warner Brothers, and I went to England and Ireland to work with John Huston on a script that Paul Newman ended up doing, a movie that Paul Newman.
Holy shit, John Huston, that must have been something.
It was, the experience was a lot better than the movie, I'm sorry to say.
Which movie was that?
Well, it ended up being called The Macintosh Man.
Oh, yeah.
It was called, the novel was The Freedom Trap.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't a terribly good movie. I liked working with John. That was a lot of fun.
Well, with someone like Sam, as you said, that he had some influence on your approach to filmmaking. Because I love Peckinpah movies, and there was a period there in my life where once a year I'd watch about five of them. You know, because he come from the old studio system and then really broke the mold, right?
Absolutely.
And there was something that I can see, like even in The Getaway, that the kind of, exploring the emotions or the possibilities of male characters is something he was really good at. And I think that character, it seems, in The Getaway, you know, was a thoughtful, kind of intense, you know, a lot under the surface kind of guy, right? I mean, what did you really pick up from Sam?
Well, I think more than any, I think I understood through him how committed you had to be to what you were doing.
Yeah.
He demanded. He was a rather fierce personality. He was not an easy fella to be around.
Yeah.
Somebody said, and I know exactly what they meant, it was like you were in some movie, except only he knew the dialogue and you didn't. And there were kind of odd pauses and interesting, but we got along well. I certainly like, he knew how much I admired him, which is always a good start, I suppose. And
smart director, man.
He was. He was very smart. He was his own, as the old thing, worst enemy. But I don't think The Getaway is his finest effort. I think it's a good movie, and it did very well. It was the most commercial movie he ever made. But I really think it was the last movie he did where he was fully in control of his medium, that that his drinking hadn't gotten out of hand yet. I mean, he was certainly drinking a lot.
Yeah.
But I don't think it got to him on that film the way it did. But he was a very complicated guy.
Yeah.
And he was constantly searching for those not loyal. And, you know, there was a lot of that.
Paranoid?
He had an alcoholic's kind of paranoid personality. Something that I had observed a great deal in my own family, so.
You avoided it.
I never wanted to be. Sam and I never were. We were always friendly. He was very encouraging to me after we did the movie. He'd call me every once in a while. I'd call him every once in a while. He was very encouraging about me. You know, but first he would say, "You sure you want to get into this shit?" And about directing, but he was very encouraging, but he was tough.
Yeah.
And he'd say, "What the fuck were you thinking of?" You know, that was
about when he started directing.
Yeah. And
so you stayed in touch with him.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Not a lot. We were not close.
Yeah.
It was just never going to work that way. I'm not a hangout kind of guy. And, he wanted more than almost anybody could give. He didn't hang out with anybody except he had a small coterie of very close, very devoted friends.
Right.
And they would drink together almost every night. I remember Warren Oates telling me, he said, "You know, everybody always thinks I'm one of Sam's guys." He said, I love him, but he said, "I can't take it." He said, "You know, those fucking guys, they get in trouble every night." And
it's smarter than that.
Yeah, he just said, "You know, I can't deal with it."
So what was the first movie you directed?
I did a movie called Hard Times.
Oh, yeah, Charles Bronson.
Charlie Bronson and Jim Cole.
Boxer movie.
That's right, street fighting back in the 30s.
Yeah, and how'd you feel about that one?
Well, it got me going, and the movie was well received, and it did pretty well. So, it
got you started.
Got me started. I liked the movie. I thought Charlie was very good in it. I thought Jimmy was good in it.
Yeah.
Charlie and I had a kind of problem in post production. His wife Jill was in the movie, and he felt that I had not been particularly kind to her in the editing, and so Charlie and I had a rather sharp breakup on that.
Did you get into a fist fight?
No, he'd have killed me, but I didn't see him but it certainly destroyed our relationship. People often ask me, you know, why didn't you ever work with him again?
And that was it?
I was just saying, son of a bitch wouldn't even speak to me.
So then you're sort of on your way, and you do the Driver, which you worked with Ryan O'Neill a few times, didn't you?
Well, I had written rewritten a script called The Thief Who Came to Dinner that Ryan did, but he and I really didn't know each other then. We had met, but then he agreed to do The Driver. The Driver was my second film. It was somewhat experimental in nature and probably, had I not been making another film at the time it came out, would have drummed me out of the business. But it was a complete financial and critical failure in this country.
But it was a respected film, though. I mean, it had found an audience, right, overseas or
it was a it became yeah it did all right,
like a cult movie.
Yeah, and it slowly has built up a reputation in this country. I'm happy to say, Edgar Wright has just made a movie called Baby Driver that is. In some ways,
oh really?
Derivative. I'll leave you to.
He's a great guy.
He's a great guy. Yeah, and very funny. I'm good friends with Edgar.
Yeah,
and I sometimes hate to think what would have happened had I not been shooting the Warriors when the Driver came out, because the reception to it was not very good. I think those days studios would send you reviews. They would collect them over the weekend and everything. I got. In the American reviews, and it's about the size of a small phone book.
Came after you, huh?
I got one good review. I got one fucking review that was any good. It was Dave Kerr. I remember it very well. Dave Kerr in the Chicago Reader gave it a beautiful review.
He got it. Yeah.
And but it was actually very well reviewed in Europe, and it did well in. It's the old joke, you know. Yeah. Did well in Japan, and
what do you think the drop off was? I mean, like if you were to look, like really consider it at that time, what was the aversion? I mean, for there to
I think there were several things. I think, in the first place, I think the movie just stylistically wasn't particularly audience friendly. It was a rather abstract way to tell the story. I think also, and I have no. I think Ryan is very good in the movie. I thought he did everything as well as I could ever hope an actor could do with the part as a writer-director. I was very pleased with Ryan. But I don't think the audience accepted him. I think they wanted the guy that was in Love Story.
Right. They couldn't accept him in a grittier role.
No. They didn't... They didn't accept him in the Steve McQueen role, you know.
Right.
And
I think that was a problem he had a lot.
Well, I suppose, you know, he had, his previous film had been the Kubrick.
Barry Lyndon.
Barry Lyndon.
Yeah.
And that had, you know, at the time.
It's not an easy movie.
It's not an easy movie, and it was at the time perceived to be not a success. Mm. But I liked Ryan, and he... He liked doing the movie, you know.
Yeah.
He liked driving. And he
sure.
Liked, he was a very physical guy. I saw him. He had this tape. You know, Ryan was a good boxer. And he worked out. He did. He fought three or four rounds with Joe Frazier.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. And,
no kidding.
Well, I don't think Joe was, you know, turning on the steam. But,
yeah.
Still, Ryan looked quite credible. You know, he had the moves.
Sure, and, sure. That, he knew how to do it.
He knew how to do it, yeah.
But the Warriors, that was the one, I mean, that was the one when I was a kid, you know, we went and we were like, what the fuck? This is insane. Like, I can still remember it, you know, the power of it. You know, it was, because I don't know how much we knew about New York or the possibilities of that, but the costumes and everything was just sort of a, it was a pretty spectacular movie. What was that guy's name? That little guy. He shows up in Spike Lee movies and stuff.
Well, his character name was Luther.
Yeah.
And David Kelly is
his,
David Patrick Kelly.
Yeah, he was great. Name.
Oh, he's a wonderful actor.
Yeah.
And
with the
guy.
Bottles Warriors.
That moment that is often quoted, I have to give him the credit for. The car was coming down. I said, you know, Jesus Christ, this is not, we need, I said, you know, you see him, I don't want to just do a reaction. I said, they wanted me to go over here and check this out. And I said, think of some fucking thing to say. I don't care. Sing to him if you want.
Yeah.
But, you know, make them know your presence and taunt them. And then I went over to the camera that we were getting ready to do on the next shot.
Yeah.
And then I came back, and I saw him out of the corner of my eye. I saw him. He jumped out of the car, and he ran under the pier, and he grabbed some old beer bottles that were there, just trash.
Yeah.
And he ran back into the car, and so I said, okay, ready to shoot. Okay, let's rehearse one more, and then we'll shoot. Action. And he does the
clinking.
Clink, clink, clink.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is what a real director is about. Is you don't get in the middle of this.
Yeah.
Just shoot it.
Yeah.
And but that was very much, you know.
That was all him, huh?
Well, it was, you know, in a way, it's kind of what directors do. It's what actors are supposed to do. Yes, he deserves the lion's share of the credit.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, I created an opportunity.
Right, sure.
And I was open to something that wasn't in the script. And so I give myself a little, I'll give myself 20% on that. And
what was the base? Where'd you get that story? I mean, like, you know, those guys with the baseball bats and the makeup. I mean, obviously, you know, I'd been to New York, and I, you know, if that world existed, it was outside of my periphery. But you, for some reason, you wanted it to exist.
Yeah, it was. I wanted to do something. It was a little bit sci-fi, a little bit futuristic, but at the same time, it had to have the crack of reality
right.
to it. And you know, it's almost a musical in some ways.
Guess, yeah, the costumes. Yeah,
yeah. And I just thought of it as it was a crazy place, and I wanted it to push the envelope. There was a scene. It was from a novel by Saul Urich. The novel is meant to be fairly realistic, and it's kind of a Trotskyite vision, I would say. But there was a scene in the novel where one of the characters is reading a comic book, and the comic book is the Xenophon story from classic Greek literature. But it was in a comic book, and the character in the book says, "Hey, these guys are just like us. Hey, you know, they're running away from..." And I said to myself, that's how to do the movie. Do it like a comic book. Do it weird and strange, and let the Greek stuff jump if it's there for anybody who wants to see it. But I think really, you know, why did you react the way you reacted?
You asking me?
Yeah, because I think you were not unique in the going, whoa, you know, hey, this is really something. And I think a lot of it was really, it was a movie where, you know, they had made a lot of gang movies before and
right.
all that kind of business. But the what was different
yeah.
that we did was we didn't examine it as a social problem movie. It was...
You just took it, you amplified it to like...
We suggested that the gangs were a rational choice for people in survival situations.
And also each gang had their own personality, and there were so many of them, you really, yeah. you were excited to see what the theme was.
And the movie didn't suggest that it was tragic that these characters were not going to become
uh-huh.
lawyers and doctors
right.
and college
right.
graduates and et cetera. It accepted them on their own terms.
It wasn't a societal problem. They were their own society.
That's right. And I think that was a very different thing at that moment. Now,
yeah.
now it's very commonplace. So
I guess, but there was still never. I've never seen anything with that many gangs. It's just that each, you know, it took that old 50s riff, you know, of territory to this other degree. Like there were all these people that had territory, but there were so many gangs, and they were so specifically different through their uniforms and you know their approach to being a gang. And the Warriors were sort of a throwback. They were like a classic, you know, just a leather vest, right? Kind of gang. And the other ones were sort of spectacular, you know, and it just created you know, something
yeah,
different.
They were the simple folk,
right?
And you know, just a few internal problems, but basically
young James Remar,
yeah, he was
he had internal problems on top of internal problems.
Who elected you war chief?
Yeah,
you
yeah know, yeah that guy.
He was had the harsh voice. And,
uh-huh.
Yeah, Remar's very good in it, and he was wonderful for me in 48 Hours and wonderful for me in several other films. You know,
Jimmy's, he's good, yeah.
Oh, Jimmy's a terrific actor.
He yeah. really is, man.
Yeah.
Very intense, very focused.
Yeah. He's, you know, he hasn't had an easy road, but he's a tremendous talent. I love him.
Yeah, and that started the role there, Warriors. Then you go to the Long Riders, and that was when we were just so thrilled at because of the brother thing. The casting all the brothers, the Carradines with the Quaids, the Christopher Guest and his brother, and who was the other one, the other big Carradines, quades.
The Keeches.
Oh, yeah, the Keeches.
I got a chance to make a Western. It was my first Western, and I was happy as a pig in shit.
Yeah.
I was just loved making it.
Love shooting it, having the horses
well,
out.
Well, I was, I'd always wanted to make Westerns.
Yeah.
And so I got my first chance at it. And
the casting was your idea?
No. I'd love to tell you it was, but James Keach had been in a play, some off-Broadway thing,
mm-hmm.
where he was played Jesse James.
Mm-hmm.
So he had the notion that it'd be good to do a movie where he was Jesse James. And he went to Stacy and said, you could be Frank. And he said, we ought to, and they had all these friends, and he said, well, you know, these gangs were all related, the Youngers and
yeah.
the Millers, and they were all related, and they all came from the same area in Missouri. So it's really a Midwestern, you know. The thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, as I said, a green Western.
Uh-huh.
And so they got an agreement among all these brothers, and they got to Tim Zinnemann, who was an old friend of mine, and Tim brought it all to me. And I said, well, I think we got a lot of work on the script here.
Yeah.
I always said, you know, we never really worked the story out very well, but there's a lot of good scenes.
Yeah.
And the characters are good.
Yeah.
You know.
And they're all good. They're good actors.
They're good actors, yeah.
Yeah. And then, like Southern Comfort, I remember that coming out because Powers Booth was so intense and menacing. I don't remember the story, but I remember being scared of the swamp.
It was a tough movie to make.
Yeah.
The swamp was unforgiving. And, yeah, Powers and Keith
yeah.
were the leads, and they were both very good in it.
And then the huge 48 Hours was a game changer for movies, in a way.
Well, you're very kind, I think. Yes, for good or bad, I think I always say this about that. I'm sure there are better movies than 48 Hours. I thought it was a really good one, but I've never seen a movie that's been imitated more. I mean, it's just.
Well, that the you know, taking the good cop bad cop thing to this area of comedy where you don't remove the menace, you know, and the stakes are still kind of high, you know, was I don't think that was done very much. You know, I noticed not long ago I rewatched like Freebie and the Bean with Khan and Arkin, that, you know, there was a time where these movies that were essentially comedies, there was still a lot of there's a pretty high body count.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I just thought that dynamic between the two of them, it was a real
well,
gift.
I always said that look, the we're going to make it like a real tough thriller.
Yeah.
And if you accept it as an action movie, it'll be very funny.
Yeah.
If you try to tell everybody it's a comedy, they're going to get a little mixed up. And and also, I always said when we're making it, don't play a joke. Don't play jokes. You know, the humor will be there. It's in the attitude and in the character. So
when you had Eddie, I mean, like, you know, that guy was
Eddie
on fire.
Was just, see, Eddie was just, it was the perfect moment for him to make a debut.
Yeah.
He was coming out of Saturday Night Live, and he did something that, there had been a series of people coming out of Saturday Night Live and having great movie careers. Instantly, great Belushi, and
yeah.
Bill Murray, et cetera, et cetera. And Dan Aykroyd, all those guys. They had these fabulous careers. But what they had done was they had jumped from Saturday Night Live to comedies.
Yeah.
Eddie jumped to a very different kind of movie, which opened up a whole new world for him of choices.
Yeah.
He could make movies. Well, for instance, Beverly Hills Cop would never have happened
right.
had he just done a conventional comedy
right.
as his debut,
I right.
mean, in my opinion.
Right. Anyway. Well, because he was able to go to have an edge, you know,
yes.
not just be a broad comedy
yeah.
character.
No, he could credibly
yeah.
carry a gun,
yeah.
Have tough attitudes,
yeah.
Et cetera, which...
that dynamic between him and Nolte was too much. Nolte is too much. He's something else, man.
Well, you know, he he was, I remember when He's the only guy in the world that calls me Walt, which I don't like. But I'm quite happy to take it from him. But he'd, I came back from New York. I'd gone back there to meet Eddie because he was shooting.
Yeah.
Saturday Night Live, and I said, I'm going to go with this guy, Nick. And I said, you know, it's going to be his first movie, and he's tremendously talented. I said, he's not an actor. You know, he's not going to be, maybe he'll be an actor by the time the movie's over.
Right.
And he's going to need your help. But I'm going to tell you this, Nick. It's going to be like doing a movie with a little kid or a dog. You got to be good every take.
Yeah.
Because the one take he's good, we're printing it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not fair, Walt. God damn it. I want to, you know, and I said, that's the way it's going to be, Dan.
And did it turn out that way? I mean, Darryl, did he show up in ways you didn't anticipate?
Number one, Nick was good in every day. You know, Eddie was not good in every day.
Yeah.
Eddie was all over the place.
Oh yeah,
but it's the old thing. You only use the good one,
right? And, he was all over the place in that he wanted to riff.
Yeah, and he was not comfortable as an actor. You know,
right.
It was a very different world for him.
Yeah,
but you know, look. The guy is an enormous talent. You yeah. couldn't hold it down.
Yeah.
But Nick was good. You know, we always, when we were editing the movie, we always said, anytime Eddie's in trouble, cut to Nick.
Yeah.
Because Nick was always doing something interesting, or he was always writing in character. And
yeah, yeah.
and they loved each other.
Yeah.
You know, they
did?
Oh, yeah. They got along great.
Yeah, Nolte was like, I don't know, he's always interesting, I'll tell you that. And that, well, you wrote that one, and then am I wrong in noticing that, like, there was some, did you start to sense, I don't know if it was in, you know, who you used as a cinematographer or your own sense, that you were, there was a style that, to your movies. Do you believe that in lighting and whatnot? Because I remember that when Remark comes out of the smoke almost, like, I remember there was some sort of vibe that, you know, you could see in Streets of Fire, I can see in the new one. I don't know, always know how that happens with directors.
Well, it's part of the job, Mark. I mean, that's, yeah, I do, you know, we work very hard on getting the look right.
Yeah.
It's always a little difficult. I mean, that's two-thirds of what you do. I think people are always, you know, there's a famous story
about
William Wyler, who was one of the four or five probably historically most successful, important directors in the history of Hollywood, and he was always known as this fabulous director of actors.
Yeah.
The performances in Wyler's movies, I think he still has the record of most nominated performances and things like that. And the young actor that comes over to him and says, my first day, Mr. Wyler, just like to know what you'd like me to do in this scene. And he said, fuck you, get in there and act. I'll tell you if it's good or not, but don't. He said, "I'm a movie director. I'm not a goddamn acting coach." Get your ass in there, and we'll see how it works. And now that's an extreme example,
yeah.
But there is a kind of, a lot of people think what a film director is closer to their conception of what an acting coach is.
Right. That I think that's right, yeah.
That you're sitting there talking to the actors about, well, do you think that maybe if he was motivated to do this,
right,
and based on whatever he had, you know, it's not like that.
Yeah.
You know, I was always very taken by how often actors in discussing working with great directors, whether it was Hitchcock or John Ford or Howard Hawks or many, the one common thing they'd always say is they never directed.
Yeah.
They never talked to, you know.
Right.
They just put the cameras up. Well, I remember Peckinpah. You ask about Peckinpah. Peckinpah told me about 75% of the job is casting. He said, if you cast it right, then you got to shoot it, and shoot it in a good way, stage it.
Well, yeah, you're paying for them to do the thing that they do,
but,
right?
Yeah, he said, you know, it's casting.
Yeah.
And but it leads you into, it's more complicated now. Look, it's, you know, I really think this, that the actors and directors, there is a, shall we say, a natural tension between the two crafts. Actors tend to believe that they can play anything. They're not often given enough of an opportunity for the breadth of their talents.
Okay.
And yeah. Directors tend to believe that if they haven't seen the person do it before, they can't do it.
Right.
And therefore, they don't want any fucking mistakes when they go out there. Because if you make a mistake in casting, the price you're going to pay is very high.
Yeah.
So if you've cast somebody that can't do the part in a reasonable way, in the way you want,
then you got to get them out.
Yeah. And I think, the truth is they're both wrong. Actors can't play just anything,
Yeah.
They do have limitations. I think they're right. They can probably play a lot more than they're given a chance to.
Right.
A lot of times.
Right.
And the directors are wrong that they are too limiting quite often. Although there is another, we're talking in cliches, which is my fault, but since I'm doing the talking here, but so many of the young directors now want to cast against the type.
Yeah.
So they'll, in my estimation, often foolishly cast so far against the type that the part lacks credibility. I'm not going to give any examples.
But yeah.
I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but...
is that part of is that an ironic position that they're taking? Do you think they know that?
That's the defense, but...
but you think it's like, they fucked up?
Yeah. Yeah.
So how did you, I don't want to just, obviously we can't go movie to movie, but you did work with Pryor, and, you work with Murphy, you work with Pryor on Brewster's Millions. How was that experience?
Well, it was mixed. I think my own arrogance. I had this feeling that I could get laughs when I wanted in movies because we had good. There was a lot of humor in The Warriors. There was a lot of humor in The Long Riders, and of course, 48 Hours had.
Sure. But you didn't write that as a comedy. 48 Hours. You just thought you were writing a straight.
No.
Thriller?
I thought we'd get laughs.
Yeah.
But I just didn't want him to play a joke.
Right.
But so I was presented the idea of Brewster's Millions. I thought, okay, I'm going to show I can do this. A pretty much straight ahead comedy. I think that was part of it. The other part of it was a lot more positive than that, which was I had a tremendous respect and admiration. I didn't know him for Richard.
Yeah.
And Richard at that time was just coming back. He had only done one movie since those close to him always said his accident.
Sure.
And so he was in a fragile state of mind. I think that was pretty much a constant with him. He was usually either very defensive or very agitated.
Yeah.
And, but... the experience, Richard felt that if he didn't take drugs, he probably wasn't funny.
Yeah.
And he also felt that if he took drugs, he'd die.
Tough position.
That's about as tough a position. And the problem was compounded by the persona of John Candy, who was in the movie, had an enormous part in the movie. Wonderful guy.
Yeah.
Wonderful guy. But,
yeah.
And John was one of these guys. As soon as he walked through the stage door, he was on and he was funny. And he loved being funny to the crew. And he knew everybody's name.
Yeah.
And he would make jokes about... your family and this.
Yeah.
He just learned, and he was always on, and he was just loved and funny, a great guy,
guy,
and very good in the movie. Well, Richard was not an outgoing person. Richard was very much a performer when he performed, but he was not a funny guy. Just
off,
off, and he would stand kind of hunched over. He spent most of his time in his trailer, but. but he, I remember he would be this kind of hunched over watching Candy.
Getting the laughs.
Yeah, getting the laughs with, and then every once in a while, it was so sad, he'd kind of try to turn something on with the crew.
Yeah.
And you could feel, it was just awkward.
Yeah.
You could feel.
Competition and, yeah.
And people would try to laugh because they, and Richard would realize they're not really laughing. They're trying to laugh to indulge me.
Yeah.
So it was like, ay, ay, ay.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Sad.
Sad.
Yeah.
So, but Richard liked the movie. He told me several times that, and as years went by, and he became very, you know, it was his favorite, he felt. I don't think it's his best by any means, but I know why he, because the movie took him on as an actor. He played a comedic, you know, it was a comedic lead as an acting role.
Yeah, right.
And he liked that. He didn't have to be a low comedian, I guess is the
right. And he didn't have to be the guy.
And he didn't have to be the guy. Yes, and so he had this enormously warm spot in his heart for the movie. This is
right. He's probably grateful too in that transition period.
And I think he grew to trust me. He started out. He was again a very wary personality.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he, you know, I was always pretty straight with him. I think, you know, there's always moments where you probably are feathering the truth a little.
Yeah.
But I liked him a lot, and I had great respect for him. And so it was, picture did well, was not terribly well received, but picture did well. And then it became this other thing. It became on television. It became this kind of enormous success.
Uh-huh.
On kids loved it.
Oh yeah,
little kids liked it, and so it had a second life.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
How'd you get involved with the Aliens franchise?
I was sitting around the office one day, and a guy I knew, Mark Haggard, literally handed me a script through the window. It was a hot day.
Yeah.
The window was open. And I said, "Hey, Mark." He said, "Hey, I've been looking for you. Couldn't find the office here." And he said, "I want you to read this script." And I read the script, called him. I said, "You know, it's not very good, but it, I think something." And I had my partner, David Giler, read it. And David, I remember it was when the Democratic National Convention, Carter was giving his speech. And,
yeah.
And David called me about 10 minutes into the speech, and he said, "I'm reading this script. He's, you know, who gives a shit what's going on in the convention?" And he said, "I'm reading this script." He said, "This is terrible." And I said, "Keep reading."
Yeah.
And 3 minutes later, he calls back because I think it was on page 35 or something. And he says, "I see what you mean. We ought to see if we can get this."
Yeah.
And it was the chest burster scene. So we had this notion, if you could take the script, turn the script into a solid something.
Yeah,
we could get it on that. If you treated a B movie like an A movie, made it real slick.
Yeah,
that it could be a real commercial movie because the framework was there.
And, but you like the egg laying in the stomach thing?
Oh yeah, that was. And the instincts were there, so we redid the studio had actually already seen the script and it passed. And they couldn't even believe that we wanted to pick
it up. Oh, really?
But
yeah,
they did. And then it became a trek to get it on, you know.
And you did a pass on the script?
Yeah, I did several. I did several passes. I made the lead character a woman. Worked out several things. And then David came back. He had gone off to Hong Kong with his girlfriend, and David came back, and then we did a couple of drafts together. But by then, the studio had read what we were doing, and they kind of saw what we saw.
Yeah.
And then, so then the hunt became, first the hunt became, who was the filmmaker going to be? and we offered it to about 35 directors. I didn't want to direct it myself. I didn't think I was really going to be good at the kind of model work,
yeah,
effects work that was
right
then. This is long before the CGI revolution,
yeah,
and all that.
Sure.
And I didn't think I was either had the patience or the technical expertise to pull that off. And so we offered it out to about 35 directors, I think. They all passed. And then we sent it to Robert Aldridge. And Aldridge called us over. Incidentally, I think the characterization of Robert Aldridge on this thing that they're doing on television now is an outrage and a travesty.
Which one?
Feud.
Oh, yeah.
Betty Day. You know, Robert Aldridge was a tremendous man, courageous man, and the idea that they're doing this to his memory. And
what are they doing to him? I didn't watch it.
Oh, they're making him a weak, second-rate director who didn't even develop the property, which is an outrageous lie.
Yeah.
And they're presenting him as this weak, vacillating person that does whatever the studio wants him to do.
Yeah.
Does whatever the sleeps with the leading ladies to make the film go a little smoother, takes orders from the actors on the set. I mean, it's just, especially Robert Aldridge. This is one of the toughest guys in the history of the Guild.
And they just took liberties?
They took they are taking unbelievable liberties. I just don't know. The other thing is Aldridge was the president of the Directors Guild for a couple of terms. Every director in the Guild is indebted to Robert Aldridge. He got the greatest breakthrough contracts. He went locked up for 2 weeks with Lou Wasserman, slugged it out, and got the greatest advances we ever got in our creative rights and minimums, et cetera. And to do this to the reputation of – I'm all for the First Amendment, and you know, I don't want to be a censor, and I don't want to say that you can't do something. But I think – to do this to the reputation of a guy that didn't do anything but make really good movies and gave his whole life to the American film is, to me, without purpose. And it's shameful. It's just shameful. I can't see that.
Just to service a story.
To service the story in a childishly melodramatic way, in my opinion.
That's a shame. I wonder if his family is pushing back at all.
His daughter called me, as a matter of fact, this morning.
Oh, really?
I guess it's one of the reasons I'm heated up about
this.
Yeah, they're in great pain over it, you know.
That's a shame.
And, you know, it's millions of people watch this. They,
it might be their only exposure to this guy.
Right. It's going to be the memory of Robert Aldridge to millions of people who otherwise don't know about his career.
Right.
And, I just think it's not illegal, I guess, and all that, but it's shameful.
Are they calling him?
And I think somebody ought to say it's shameful.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm.
You're the guy.
I guess right now I'm the guy.
And they're calling him by name in the movie.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
It really is. Sorry. What would?
He had the alien script.
Oh yeah, and he said he was a tough old guy.
Yeah.
And he said I like the script. He said, you know, it's a. You got the monster, and you got a patrol movie.
Yeah.
He said, you know, and all that. And he said, I know how to do this. And he said, the movie will succeed or fail on the conception of the beast.
Yeah.
He said, we got to come up with something really unique.
Yeah.
And he said, I don't know, just off the top of my head. This may not be a good idea, but you know, maybe we get like an orangutan and shave it, and we go, God Almighty, that's one we hadn't thought of.
Yeah,
and you know, then train the son of a bitch, and we just because you shouldn't see it very much, you know. But he said something. It's got to be really weird and strange, and so we always thought Ridley did a wonderful job. Bob agreed to do the movie, but then he had a movie come out. Well, he couldn't shoot the movie in England where the movie where Fox wanted to make it.
Yeah.
Because he couldn't leave the presidency of the Directors
Guild. Right, right, right.
So it went on to Ridley, who David had seen The Duelist at the Cannes Film Festival and was very impressed with it. Beautifully shot. Sound work was great. So Ridley liked the script. He came over and...
Well, how'd you get from a shaved orangutan to the Geiger stuff?
Well, the I guess I wasn't kind in my assessment of the original script, but the fellas that wrote the original script had were familiar with Giger's work.
Giger, sorry, yeah.
And they showed us the pictures and then and the picture books of Giger's work, and we showed it to Ridley. And Ridley said, well, this is, our problems are solved.
Yeah.
And so it went from there.
And you were involved with all of them. You didn't direct the first one, but obviously we had a big part in the script, and then...
And I was involved in the first three.
Yeah.
I'm listed as one of the producers on everything since, but Fox and I got, as usual, we got in a fight with the studio, and we negotiated a settlement.
Yeah.
We're still listed as producers by their insistence, but we still maintain some ownership in the franchise. Jim Cameron directed the second
one. Oh, that's right, too. That's right. Yeah.
I saw Jim just Monday, sadly, at Bill Paxton's memorial.
Paxton was in here 2 weeks before he passed, talking to me.
I ran into Bill at my doctor's office with some irony. I hadn't seen Bill in a couple of years. Bill and I were very good friends.
Great guy.
Wonderful guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your moment with him was wonderful.
Oh, I was so happy it happened, man.
Well, it really got the essence of him, too. I mean...
Oh, good.
That's the way he was.
That's great. Good to hear. Yeah, sweet guy, man. Just a shame. Real sad. I really liked the movie Geronimo, and I wanted to tell you that.
Thank you.
I don't know where it went or how it did, but well. Yeah.
Didn't do well for a couple of reasons, but I was very pleased with it. I thought it accomplished what we wanted to accomplish, and I thought the story was a moving one.
Yeah.
And I thought the camera work on it was well done, and I thought it
looked beautiful.
I thought Ry Cooter's score was wonderful, and
he's great. Are you friends with him?
Sure.
How's he doing?
He's doing great. He's still living over there in Santa Monica Canyon, and he tours, and he's
a real wizard, that guy.
He may be the most talented person I've ever worked with. I mean, I always say that about Ry. He lives wonderfully inside his own head, and he lives in this world of music, and he's wonderfully adaptive of taking strains of great American music and then making it uniquely his own.
Yeah.
And he's a joy. He's a joy.
Yeah, he's a real gift to music. There's such a huge catalog to sort of like – get to know him through. But I like that movie. Jason Patrick, I thought, was great.
And Jason's very good in it.
And Milius is there was something about that guy. I don't know him, but ever since I saw that documentary about the making of Apocalypse Now, and they interviewed Milius, and he's like, Francis had convinced us that we were making the first film to win the Nobel Prize. Like, there was just such a swagger to his writing. And like, I like that thing.
Oh, he's a wonderful writer. Yeah. I always say that my generation of screenwriter, I think that John's scripts read the best. If you wanted to read a script, John was absolutely the most powerful storyteller. He wrote beautiful scripts.
Yeah. How's he doing?
He's got health problems.
Uh-huh.
And they've prevented him from working in the last few years.
Uh-huh. And so now the new one, to get up to speed, The Assignment, I hear you already got into a little trouble with that, or no?
No, I think, yes, the movie's been attacked roundly. I mean, it's also been defended. I hasten to point out, but there were people that felt that the movie treaded on ground that should not be examined. The movie was roundly criticized before it even was not only not seen, it was even made.
Yeah.
But the subject matter was perceived to be verboten by several people, and they didn't want the first place. It is not a movie about transgender. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Well, it's a, you know, it is a movie that deals with genital alteration and
but it's so it's so clearly a horror trope.
Yeah,
and it's a
revenge. It's a comic book.
It's a take on something creepy. There's a lot of elements in there that are very familiar to everyone. But that turn, that bizarre turn of that script, where this vengeful doctor, gets back at the man who killed her brother in this bizarro way, is it's like it can't be seen as really connected to reality on some level.
No, I mean, and if.
And I don't even think you did a disservice to either character, the male or the female character.
Well, I'm a great believer that, what is fundamentally the most important thing that any director or any storyteller can have, and that is sympathy for the human condition.
Yeah.
Is ultimately sounds grandiose, but it is the fundamental. Now, you may approach it through many different ways. You can approach it through comedy or serious drama or irony or comedy. But I leave both. The movie pits a trained medical doctor who's also an intellectual who has a agenda and has a tragic past herself against the lowest form of criminal Darwinian survivor on the, to use one of Bill Paxton's favorite phrases, on the food chain.
Yeah.
They don't come any lower than Frank Kitchen. And these two diametrically opposed types are thrown up against each other in a double revenge thing. And the movie finally, it seems to me, shows sympathy and elevates both characters.
Yeah.
Again, through a comic book format.
Yeah.
It is a graphic novel that I co-wrote, but
it started as a graphic novel.
Didn't start. It started. Dennis Hamill wrote a story and script in 1977.
Yeah,
and I read it then, and I always thought, God, this is a hell of a an idea.
Yeah,
and I didn't do a goddamn thing for 15 years. I think it was. Then I optioned it. And I co-wrote a script, which I didn't go right, just didn't, and I never really did anything with it. I just abandoned it and gave the story back to Dennis. And then another 10 years went by, and I was stumbling around the basement, and I ran across his original, and I thought, I always loved this thing. And suddenly, and it's one of those, I don't think anybody ever believes you when you say it, but within about an hour, I figured out how I wanted to do it. Now, I knew certain things. I wasn't going to get a big budget. I wanted to do it neo-noir. I wanted to do it comic book. I wanted to do it as a kind of somewhat larger version of one of the tales from the crypt that I had done in the past, where you take nasty people, pit them against each other and leave them in a chastened condition.
Yeah.
And so I think the film accomplished that. I've seen it with audiences. It seems to play very well.
Yeah.
And the movie is within a certain off-center format. It's not very realistic. It has nothing to do with transgender. And it... it's kind of a, there's a lot of would-be humor in it, as well as, the little especially the stuff between Sigourney and...
And Shalhoub.
And Tony, yeah.
Yeah. And where's the graphic novel come into this? You wrote...
While I was in... I turned the script in when I finished my version of the script.
Yeah.
I gave it to my agent, and he said, well, Jesus Christ, nobody's going to make this.
Yeah.
And, I said, well, great. And
good news.
Yeah. And he said, look, I was on my way to Munich. They were doing a retrospective of my movies at the Munich Festival.
Uh-huh.
He said, on your way back from Munich, stop in Paris. He said, I know a producer there. Maybe he'll go for it. He's kind of an odd guy. He'll go for it. He'll go for it. So I did. I stopped in Paris. And while I was in Paris, and it turned out he was quite right.
Yeah.
The French producer, Saïd Ben Saïd, decided to back the movie as long as I promised that I would make it very quickly and very cheaply.
Yeah.
And that we got some kind of name casting in it.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I had written another graphic novel a year or so before, a gangster piece, which was published in France. And so I called up the publishers and said, I've got another one here that I think would probably make a graphic novel. They agreed. And so simultaneously, the graphic novel started being put together.
And you used some elements of that in the film.
Some
comic panels. And
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's definitely a genre piece.
It is indeed.
Yeah. Was it another sort of, was the concept to take that sort of B-movie vibe and elevate it again?
Yes, I'm not even sure elevate is the right. It is, as soon as somebody says this is low and this is lurid, I say absolutely, it is.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of the fun of it. I think Michelle's very good in it, and I think Sigourney's very good at it.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of the acting in it.
Yeah, and the lead, Michelle, that's her name?
Michelle Rodriguez.
Yeah, she's great, yeah.
As usual, everybody told me, she's, very difficult. You don't want to cast her.
Uh-huh.
And we met for lunch, and I said... Everybody tells me not to cast you because you're so difficult. Oh, fuck them. So we talked about, I liked her right away. She really is she comes from a very hard background.
Uh-huh.
And she is a real off the streets girl. And at the end of the lunch, she stood up and she said, I don't know who the fuck you're going to cast in this thing, but she said, I'll tell you one thing, guy or girl, you're never going to find anybody going to handle the guns better than me. And she walked away. And she was right. I of course cast her.
Yeah. And how do you like shooting like quick and fast? Was it all digital?
We didn't use film. Yeah, it's digital. Well, how do I feel about it? I'm not one of those directors that likes lots of takes.
Yeah.
So that wasn't particularly a challenge, but at the same time, I'd like to have had another 5 days or something like that.
Yeah.
Another slug of money. You always think you could, movies is, in the end, they're never everything that you want them to be.
Yeah.
They have problems.
Sure.
And you think you could have done this a little better, that's a little better, but I certainly think I wanted to do something very neo-noir.
Uh-huh.
I wanted it, again, within the graphic novel framework.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to work with women.
Yeah.
I mean, so many of my films, people always say, he's a very masculine director and all that. So, it's that human instinct that whatever people say, you want to show them the opposite
Sure.
is true.
Yeah.
And there it is.
Yeah.
Listen, nobody makes movies that please everybody. That's just not.
And
you should never complain. I've had a very lucky career. Don't ever complain about this. There's a great quote that I'm probably going to get wrong.
From
Dr. Johnson saying that we come uncalled into the arena to seek our fortune and hazard disgrace. And that's exactly right. Nobody asks you, You came into it.
Yeah.
You play the goddamn cards you're dealt, and you take your chances.
Yeah, and you can't see it coming necessarily.
No, that's right. And you do what you can with what you got, and you take your chances.
Yeah, you've weathered some storms. I mean, Warriors got. I mean, the people are getting killed, right?
Yeah. No, that's right. Somehow. Well, they always say the same thing.
Yeah.
The biggest trick is to stay in the game, and I can't believe, I've actually been a director now for over 40 years, and I've been making a living in the town for 50 years.
Showbiz.
Showbiz,
yeah. Yeah, and what do you got coming up?
I've just optioned a play that was off Broadway, another female lead.
Uh-huh.
I'm becoming a director of women.
Good.
And I'm working on that script with the author of the play.
What play?
It's called Bethany.
Uh-huh.
And it's Laura Marks is the Marks, not like Carl.
Uh-huh.
And is the author of the play. And it's a psychological thriller, I guess, for lack of a better.
Oh, cool. Excited about it?
Yes.
Well, great. Well, it's certainly a great honor talking to you, Mr. Hill.
Well, thank you. Again, and thanks for the, at Bill's Memorial, they played some of the
podcast. Oh, really?
Podcasts.
Oh, yeah, I think they asked us. That was very nice of them to ask.
And it was, it helped inform, and it was terribly moving, the service for those of us that knew him. He was a very special person.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss, and I was thrilled that I got to spend that time with him, and honored that they used it at.
Well,
the
I think it's your show with him is going to be probably the most fitting testament to those that want to look back.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad I provided that.
Sure.
Great talking to you.
Thank you.
That was exciting, right? A little history for you. What an amazing life. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour. I've got a few more dates coming up. Madison, Wisconsin this week. Milwaukee, Minneapolis this Saturday for the special. Then a little later and a few weeks after that, I got Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. If those sound good to you or you're in the area, go to WTFpod.com/tour for that. Go to WTFpod.com to pre-order the new book, Waiting for the Punch, Words to Live By from the WTF Podcast. I can play some dirty guitar. I brought the magic instrument out here, and I'm going to plug it into an old thing. Boomer lives!